In today's episode, I interviewed a man who seems to be buying up accountancy practices across the UK to build an empire. Johan Gori, Managing Director of On Point Accounting Group, has done so many acquisitions this year already, we've lost count. And in this episode, I'm going to grill him on finding the truth of what these strategic accountancy firm acquirers actually look for when buying a firm. You're going to get loads of practical tips on how to maximize the value of your accountancy firm today. So welcome to Firm Up, where you'll get all the mindset and practical tips on how to build an exceptional firm. Enjoy. Johan, welcome. Hello. Welcome to Firm Up. Let's start off. Just talk to me about how you entered the accounting industry.
Cool. So I entered the accounting industry from a non-traditional background, shall we say. So I used to work for a company, outdoor adventure company, who used to do school trips. Residential school trips. So the schools would come away Monday to Friday, Friday to Monday, and stay over. I joined them at the age of 18, not sure what I wanted to do with life, thinking I'll do that for a year while I decide. So I joined them as a housekeeping assistant, going in mopping toilets and stuff. Then by the time I left that company, it was 2017, and I was one of their finance managers. The area I'd tend to focus on mainly was improving other managers' awareness of budgets and stuff. So catering manager, absolutely phenomenal operations manager of running a catering side of business. Housekeeping manager, fantastic at running the housekeeping. Rooms always cleaned on time. Budget control, slightly different issue. So I started off as a housekeeper. I went into their retail department. When I got into management of the retail departments, they then decided, well, retail and finance, it's the same thing. We'll merge those. So, Johan, you're now a finance retail manager, naturally. So I worked with them as a finance manager for 4 or 5 years. And by the end, I was getting a lot of drinks brought for me in the pub by friends that had gone out and set up their own business. And they were very small businesses, just like your local canyoning instructor or your canoeing instructor or your cycling coach or something. But they couldn't get the simplest of support from accountants and bookkeepers because either the local firms were too big and weren't interested or they were too expensive if they were prepared to spend time with them. So they ended up buying me pints in a pub, answering questions on very basic things. I was like, well, if I can destroy a liver on this, probably build a bank balance. I was 27, single, living in a very cheaply rented apartment that was part of a holiday let. So all I had to do was cut the grass and pay a very nominal fee, and that covered my utility bills, etc. And so I looked at it, and I worked it out. I was like, oh, I need about 20 grand a year to maintain this lifestyle. I was quite happy with that. And then just as I was umming and ahhing about things, the company I was working with got sold to capital venturists, basically. All of a sudden, minimum standards started getting introduced everywhere, like, don't exceed this, just do this. We don't want thoughts and ideas, we just want you to do this. And they started introducing cost savings they weren't breaking any safety rules, but they weren't setting the best standards for young people that were being exposed to that outdoor activity for the first time. And then there was lots of talks about having to slash staffing costs, etc. And it's like, I don't want to be involved in those conversations where I'm having to tell managers that you don't have a budget for that many staff now, you need to deliver it on this. Like, you know, in a year I could easily save someone their centre's 80k in cost control and renegotiating contracts with suppliers. So with that, plus the fact that actually I've got quite, you know, I'm enjoying helping my friends run their small businesses, I decided to go it alone. October 2017, I put my notice in and I went down to part-time. December 2017, I packed it in and I've been running my business ever since then.
Amazing. So actually not too long ago that you joined the industry, not at all. And fast forward then, however many years that is, six-ish, almost 6 years, and your firm has acquired multiple other accountancy mm-hmm. businesses. And I'm guessing that you seeing that standard of acquisition while you were at that company kind of set the tone for you as to say, this is what I don't want my acquisitions to look like.
Yeah, I think subconsciously it had an impact. I was never meant to grow an accounting firm. It was only ever meant to be a small bookkeeping business that could keep my lifestyle going. So I read a book very close to the time I went self-employed, Big Ideas for Small Businesses, from John Lamberton. And the overriding message was he wanted a business that worked for him and delivered the lifestyle he wanted. I just tagged onto that over the years. It's got to deliver the lifestyle I want at the time I want it. So at the time I started, you know, 20-odd clients, just bookkeeping and tax returns, dead simple. That was delivering what I needed. I then met my now wife. We got on nice holidays. We've got a light, you know, we've got a mortgage and stuff to pay. So all of a sudden, I needed to bring in more money. You know, I mean, for a very long time in the relationship, my wife earned a lot more than I did. But we got to the point where we wanted to buy a house and settle down and properly and stuff. So it's like, right, I need to start earning more money. So we need to grow the business. How do I grow the business? Well, I'm not a marketing expert. I'm not good at advertising or SEO or any of that stuff. And the first acquisition kind of happened by accident. It was 2020, just at the start of it. I was in a Facebook group and someone said to me, look, Johan, life's thrown a spanner in the works. My business is up to its eyeballs in debt. She was an amazing bookkeeper.
Terrible business owner.
Absolutely. Like, signed up to every coaching program, every bit of software, didn't use any of them. She said, look, I've separated from my husband. I've got two kids with a lot of learning difficulties. So I need to go and get a PAYE job. I'll service the debt and stuff. Can you just look after my clients? So that doesn't seem a fair deal. So I looked at it and I said, look, I need a new bookkeeper. I'm at capacity. With the capacity that I need, plus your clients, you would be full capacity, give or take a bit. So I'll take on your business. I'll take on all its debts, so you don't have to worry about it. I'll give you a pound for the business, and I'll give you a fully paid, full-time PAYE job, so you've got the security you need for you and your kids. And I'll give you complete flexible working, so you can work around whatever you need to do with the kids, which has proven so invaluable for her, because one of the kids is now homeschooled. So the husband does mornings, she does the afternoons, she works in the mornings, and she works in the evenings. Absolutely fine. So that was my first acquisition. And it's like, actually, that was a really easy way of picking up 50 new clients. That was a lot easier and probably just as expensive as doing SEO and all this other stuff that I ain't got a clue about. And I couldn't tell you if a marketing person was scamming me or delivering real value for money. So instead of going down that marketing route, we said, actually, we'll do acquisitions. That would be yes, we'll have organic growth through referrals, recommendations. Yes, we'll, you know, go to local events for businesses and stuff like that. But ultimately, our rapid growth will come through acquisitions.
And just before we get into, because there is so many questions whizzing around in my head about how, where, when, what do we look for? There's an important piece of the puzzle here, which is your background in leadership and management. The fact that you could spot that and say, that's not a fair deal, so I'm going to do X instead. And you could then use the fact that you didn't have skills in marketing, but actually just buy the clients in. So how did this, and especially in comparison to a lot of other accounting and bookkeeping firms, what kind of knowledge can you help impart for those firms who don't have a degree
mm-hmm.
in management and leadership?
Yep.
But just, you know, how has that impacted the way you run your firm?
I have to take my hats off to accountants and bookkeepers. What they can do is incredible. I have a smidgen of experience, my team will tell you, in bookkeeping. I'm quite good at self-assessment tax returns. I can knock them out at quite a good rate. But they won't let me loose with accounts and corporation tax and stuff. It's just not worth the mess I make. So I started my bookkeeping firm at the time based on the IAB certifying me based on experience, worked fine. I knew what I was comfortable doing. And then I knew if I needed to grow, if I wanted to add on more services, I'd need to employ someone to deliver those services. Which was the part that I wasn't worried about. Like, because in my role at the old job, I'd worked my way through MVQ-based qualifications for leadership and management. And I'd got my degree in it, and it was something I really enjoyed. Well, you know, I don't get me wrong, I sit there listening to Accounting Web as a podcast, but whilst others are listening and watching tax updates and stuff, I'm sat listening to Simon Sinek's latest podcast or something like that.
Yeah. For just for the listeners, Simon Sinek, leadership guru, both of us absolutely adore him.
He's incredible. So, yeah, you know, whilst others are reading up on HMRC guidance, I'm sat reading books on leadership and management. That's my passion. And I think it always has been ever since I was like in scouts. I always enjoyed the leadership roles. So I knew if I needed to recruit people, I could lead them. I knew how I wanted to be treated as an employee if I was an employee. And I knew what people were going to be looking for in the future, which, you know, that was my USP. Yeah. And then COVID ruined it, because all of a sudden we all now agree that flexible working is the right way and people can work from home, that's fine. But until COVID, I was pretty much one of the only ones out there doing it. So that was my USP watered down somewhat. But yeah, I know what I'm good at is leadership of a team and people, developing culture in the workplace, and managing processes and systems and making them more efficient.
Yeah.
They're my three main skills.
Which is just incredible, because as a business owner, that is absolutely, you know, if someone was to ask me what is the most important part of running a business, they are the very, very, very high top priority. But obviously coming in as an accountant or a bookkeeper, it's difficult, especially if you've come from working in practice or even in industry. It is very difficult to snap out of accounting mindset.
And that is the main problem people have got, is they've got this mindset of, I'm an accountant, I'm a bookkeeper.
Yeah.
I'm a business owner. My business happens to deliver accounting services, bookkeeping services, tax services. Like, if anyone asks, well, so what do, Johan? Oh, I run a group of accounting firms. Like, I am the business owner. I'm the business manager. I never go, I'm an accountant or I'm a bookkeeper. A, because that would be false on my part. But B, because that's not the mindset I've ever had. I've always said I'm a business owner. Mm-hmm. And not only do we have accountants and bookkeepers that they go through college, university, into big firms and or little firms and come out and then go and set up on their own, and they are still in this mindset of, I'm an accountant, I'm a bookkeeper, but they've never had a decent role model as a manager or leader.
Yeah.
You know, like, some might have, but it'll be a rare instance, because we don't teach management or leadership skills to accountants and bookkeepers at any point in their career, and we don't recognise it on their CPD either.
And any business, any industry is in the people business.
Yeah. Like, even now, we're talking about AI and the implementation of ChatGPT and stuff. And everyone's like, oh, jobs losses. Like, no, jobs re-engineering. What happened when receipt capture softwares came out? It just re-engineered the time spent on processing documents from that to allowing bookkeepers and accountants to spend more time talking to their clients and offering higher value services.
Yeah.
Like, that's all AI is going to do. It's going to empower us to spend more time doing the bits that our clients find valuable.
Yeah. So how many acquisitions are you on now?
4.
Nice. And that's been in the last 3 years?
Yeah.
Amazing. So you're building somewhat of a group.
Yes. So we've got a group, and we've also spun off a few bits. So, like, we did an acquisition of a payroll bureau, which never really went anywhere. It sat there dormant. I think I've just found the right person to really drive that forwards. So that sat there in the wings, ready to spin off. We had a spin off for R&D tax credits, but we've backed out the market because of the issues with the amount of cowboys in it at the moment, and we don't want that reputation associated to us. So yeah, there's like 5 or 6 different businesses, 7 if you include the franchising business that we've not done anything with yet, but it's an idea that's there.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's group now.
Yeah, it's incredible. In just a few years, incredible. Yeah. And when you make these acquisitions, what's the first move? Do you go looking for them, or do they generally come to you?
Sounds really, really big-headed.
Never.
But they come to me. They know I'm looking. I don't ever go looking. They come to me. And we've been quite strategic in the acquisitions we've done. Like, I probably speak to an average one or two acquisition opportunities a month. But in the last 3 years, we've only done three or four. Two of them are completely unstrategic and insignificant from a public PR point of view. But they were important to us at the time, that we needed payroll person. So we acquired a small payroll business that wanted to just go employed. We need a new bookkeeper. So we took on Vicky's business. Now Vicky, who is the lady I was talking about earlier, she's now my head of accounts. Like, she's still with us. Then the last two acquisitions were more strategic from a PR point of view. So Mind Your Assets from Bev Flanagan, Joe Wood's Virtual FD Services from Joe Wood. They were very deliberate because we knew the PR and the publicity we'd get with those. And we knew that they would rekindle some conversations and demonstrate a certain level of trust and expertise in the field. But I always think, if we've only done four in 3 years and I have an average of one or two inquiries a month, tells you how much stuff we say no to. We don't take every opportunity that comes across our desks, basically.
Which obviously begs the question, what's the difference between the ones you say no to? So let me just ask you this more specifically, because I can imagine there is lots of contextual factors that have an impact on that decision. But you get these conversations once or twice a month, and you've said strategically, the two that have been the most strategic have been for PR purposes, and those, the people who own those businesses have quite a strong personal brand in the industry. Yep. They're very well known, very well respected. But I also know the other side of the argument, which is if a company is too heavily reliant upon a single key person, which obviously go proposal, it's been through the acquisition process, we had James Ashford, there are two sides of the coin in the M&A process, in that personal brand is obviously really, really strong for acquiring new customers, PR purposes, but can, if that business is too dependent on that person, hold back the value. It can even stop that business getting acquired in the first place. So talk me through, like, what that means to you, which side of the coin you stand on.
Both sides are completely valid. And the reason we did the two that we've done is because, actually, yes, those business owners were the face of the business. But when you actually looked at the inner workings, how much of the work were they actually doing? So, like, yes, I am the face of on-point accounting. But actually, the amount of work I actually do on the client work is minimal. My team are very grateful for that. But the thing I do is meetings with clients that are looking at acquisitions and due diligence themselves, because I do it myself. That's a huge selling point to the client. They love that. But the majority of the work, if I didn't turn up for work for the next 9 weeks, my business will continue running as it is today. And that was fairly much the same for the last two businesses.
Very specific number, 9 weeks.
It's mainly because I'm scarred by the fact that as of this week, I'm pretty much out of the business for nine weeks.
And what are you doing?
Roadshows for software providers. Nice. I'm all over the country for a lot of roadshows and stuff, and then speaking at various things. Then I'm on holiday for 2 weeks, then I'm back for 2 days, and then I'm at the small business show. And it's like, actually combined, I think I've got like 14 days in the next 9 weeks where I'm free in the office.
What's that?
But it's because I'm in that position that if anyone looked at our business for acquisition, they could go, actually.
Yeah.
Not only is Johan saying he's not involved, we can see by his diary he's not involved.
Yeah.
So, like, if you look at Jo Wood's business, you can see by her diary and her social presence, actually, she spends a lot of time with the six-figure bookkeepers, speaking at conferences. That's only feasible if your business is running on by itself. It may not be growing while you're not there. It may just be stagnant, but it's still stagnant. It's not declining. It's not causing a backlog in problems. So whilst those two businesses had a big personal brand associated to it, actually the day-to-day operations had very little of anything for them to do.
Yeah, which is very similar to the James Ashford Go proposal acquisition scenario as well, which is really, really helpful, I think, for people to hear that a personal brand is so valuable and so, so important. but that cannot be what runs the business
exactly.
in the back end.
And also, there's a lot of people I've come across that have been trying to get, they've actually maybe stepped away from the business too soon or too quickly, and it's been detrimental to the business. So they know, oh, I want to sell in 3 years' time. Well, I know I'm going to get more money if I step away. And they just step away.
Okay.
Like, hands off, no problems. It's like, ooh, hang on. You've not put the team in place. You've not trained that team to the right level. You've not installed the culture in that team at a deep enough level for them to emulate that while you're not there. And you've not put the processes in place. So actually what you're doing is detrimental to the business.
Yeah.
So you need to get the team, the culture and the processes right before you can go, and I'm free.
Yeah.
And I'm done.
And what is that? What does that look like? So what does a team right and in place look like to you?
Varies business by business, depending on services and stuff. But ultimately, a team has to have a leader.
Yeah.
So in my team, I've got Jade. Jade's my operations manager. Jade joined me as a part-time bookkeeper in 2018. Like, she was one of my first hires. Absolutely incredible. She gets the culture. She gets the ethos. She's very good at counteracting my willingness to just jump and do something.
Yeah.
Like, new software. Oh, yes, please. Oh, this is going to be amazing. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. She goes, hang on a minute. Have you thought of X, Y, and Z? It's like, no, but give me an hour. I'll come back and I'll have answers for you. At which point she said, cool, you've answered my questions. Carry on.
Yeah.
So she is very much the yin to my yang, as it were.
And I'm laughing, by the way, because I was your Jade. I was James Ashford's Jade.
Right.
That exact,
everyone needs one.
That's what I mean. Yeah, I'm laughing because this blueprint is obviously like crosses industries.
Definitely.
And different scales. So love that.
Yeah. So Jade knows and emulates the culture that I want from my team and towards our clients at all times. And she's great at maintaining that. She's the first person to say, I don't do sales. I don't do this. I don't do that. It's like, fine. If that's not your preference, it's not your strengths, I get it. To maintain that business on a stagnant level, on a day-to-day basis, she's absolutely incredible at. So you need leadership
mm-hmm.
in some form. From there, how it looks is, as in my, you know, as a generic point of view, our deadline's being met before or on time. You know, we've got internal deadlines that are quite stringent. So we try and get all VAT returns to our clients by the 18th of the month. After that, it's the client's job to sign it off and we'll file it once they do that. We try and get all accounts done within 3 months of year end. Like, we are trying to improve our responsiveness of service. Now, how we deliver that will look different in every single business. But ultimately, I know the team are working towards a goal and the culture that I want in my absence because of Jade.
Yeah.
So you still need that leadership person.
And processes, systems, and deadlines being met. I know one of the biggest issues in accountancy firms is clients not responding, clients not being accountable, respecting deadlines. Is that a red flag?
Not a huge red flag, because I go back to the two sides of a coin analogy. Yes, the clients aren't responding, they aren't doing things, but have they been educated as to why?
Yeah.
I'm not saying that they've not been. I'm just saying it's a question, and we know what our success rate is of training clients to behave and do work how we want to work them to work. So actually, that's not a huge issue for me, because I know we've got the skill set to deliver that ourselves.
That's great. And then let's talk about calculations.
Okay.
Monetary
yep.
calculations of how much a firm is worth. Now, this changes dependent on the market, dependent on the news,
yep.
dependent on regulation, on new legislation.
Yep.
But just give me, how do you generally do your calculations today, and what do you think that could look like in 3 to 5 years' time?
Not being an accountant, I'm not obsessed with balance sheets and profit and loss. That's probably the last thing I look at. Cash flow is my, in my opinion, if you look at a business, cash flow is the blood that you pump around your business. That's what keeps it alive. That's what delivers its oxygen. So you have to have cash flow. If you've not got cash flow, you can't do anything. You can't grow. You can't reinvest. You can't go on a nice holiday because you've treated yourself. So we look at cash flow first, and we look at what the business itself can afford to pay. However we structure the deal in the long run, whether it's deferred consideration or borrowing money to then pay the initial consideration and deferred, whatever it is, ultimately that business has got to be able to afford whatever we do, because I can't put the rest of my businesses under strain to take on another business. It's got to be cash flow neutral or positive. So we start from there. Like, we look at the cash flow and go, right, we'll rip out all the money the directors are taking. Let's have a look at what group savings we can do. And that gives me a figure of each month of, okay, I could afford to pay that to the business owner or the accountant or bookkeeper, whatever we want to call them. From there, I go, right, what does that look like in terms of multipliers of recurring revenue? Because that's what accountants and bookkeepers have been trained. That's the myth, the legend. You're going to get a multiplier of your recurring revenue. So like I do when I speak to my clients, I put it into their terminology. So it's like, I could tell you how I've done all this with cash flow and we've done this multiplier of EBITDA, but you aren't going to relate to that. You've been told for years that it's a multiplier of your recurring revenue. So I then go, right, the business can afford to pay this each month. That equates to this multiplier of recurring revenue. Whether that's 0.5 to 1.3, whatever it is, they can then go, is that in line with what I want? Is that going to deliver me the lifestyle I want? And not all deals are going to work because of the way we structure deals. So we work primarily on deferred consideration. So our people that are selling up will get a lump sum every month for however many months we agree to pay them for, which will result in the overall value of the business that we've agreed. So if someone's like going to sell my business and the initial consideration, so that first payment, is going to pay off my mortgage, we aren't here to do a deal with you. That's not going to work for us, because we're not going to go out and borrow that money, because of how expensive it is to borrow money at the moment. Means we'd be offering you less money for the business because it's not affordable. There are deals that we've lost out on because, you know, some people don't sell to us because we're not a chartered organization. Like, we're not chartered, we deal with small businesses, there's no need for it. Others won't sell to us because I'm a man and I'm leading the business and they want a female owned business, and that's absolutely fine. Others want their money up front. Again, it means they're then not getting the money they want for the business, because we've got to then afford all the interest payments and the arrangement fees with the banks and stuff. So how we structure a deal won't suit everyone, and that's fine. But ultimately, we go by cash flow basis of what can the business afford each month based on its current performance to pay you. That'll be by saving money from paying directors. Means if we're not paying the director's car anymore, that's a bonus. It might be group benefits. So, you know, we have more clients. That means we've got more buying power. So when I go to software providers and go, I want 80 licenses, they go, well, that's this price. If I then go around, actually, I want 500 licenses, they'll go, oh, well, that's a lot cheaper per license because of the bulk. So we get some benefits of size through that and scales of economy.
And what about the layout of clients versus team? Is there any sort of green or red flags in your head if there is a high ratio of clients versus team members?
It's interesting. So we operate on what we call pods. Yeah. So we have a client manager, and that client manager looks after a portfolio of clients. Some client managers' portfolios are based on that client manager's preference of industry. Some are very small pods but are very high revenue earning, because that client is paying for daily bookkeeping, all your management and cash flow reports, blah blah blah. And other pods have got like 100 clients in them because they're just small tax return clients and small bookkeeping clients. So we don't really look at the number of clients as much as we do. We look at it, but we also take into consideration the revenue that client pod's going to generate for us, the profitability of that client pod to deliver it. So each client pod has the cost of payroll service attributed to them, because our payroll team don't sit in a pod. They're independent, as it were. Same with our accounts team. Now, ultimately, the dream would be that each pod has its own payroll person. Each pod has its own accounts person. So ratios of clients to team members and stuff doesn't really worry me. That's a micro detail that I'll deal with later. And we've normally got enough capacity. If we're buying someone that's over capacity slightly, I'd rather that, knowing that some clients are going to drop off. Even if the business owner has not spoken to that client in 3 years because their team's doing everything for them, they'll still go, I was there for the so-and-so factor.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, but you've not spoken to that person in 3 years. Yeah, but I'm still there because that's the person whose business I signed up to. So they're gonna leave, and that's fine. So if they're over capacity, it doesn't really worry me, because we know we're going to see a little bit of loss. We are quite proud that our losses of clients on an acquisition, the worst we've ever had is 10% loss. We average about 5 in the first year, which when you look at most acquisitions is pretty low.
And why is that? What are you doing differently? What are you doing so well?
I think it's we have a process in place. So, you know, when we buy a business, the business owner first speaks to the staff and then brings me in to that meeting, and I tell them what I'm going to deliver, and I deliver it within the first 2 weeks of the deal. So, you know, we put life insurance or death in service in place for them straight away. Put medical insurance in place, income protection insurance in place. We look after them and their families immediately. We then do unlimited holiday. We do flexible working. And, you know, there's a lot of people that go, oh my God, how does that work? Is that, you don't need to worry about how it works. Just know that if you need time off, you can take time off. But we look after the staff. We prove to the staff that they can trust us. At which point, when they're then speaking to their clients, like, you know what, this guy's been brilliant. Everything they promised us, they've delivered already. If they're promising you they're going to be improving services or something, they'll deliver it. You know, on top of that, the business owner then speaks to the clients on a one-to-one basis. Now, that might be a phone call, might be face-to-face, it might be email. That's up to the business owner, deemed on the value and perception of the clients. But after every communication of that, even if it's a phone call, it's followed up by an email re-explaining everything with a link to my diary. So anyone can book in to have a, you know, don't need anything. They just want to say, hello, who's the new guy?
Yeah.
So we do that.
Which I can imagine a lot of people won't do, but just the gesture of having that.
It's the proactiveness.
Yeah.
You know, like I send out a email to all of our clients. Well, not me, the team and the system sends out an email to all of our clients, inviting them to a 9-month tax planning meeting. Like, you're 3 months away from the year end. I'd say less than 5% take us up on it. But they're like, oh, they're so proactive. They're so forward thinking. Like, yeah, they don't, just because you do it doesn't mean anyone's going to take you up on it.
Yeah.
So a few clients will take you up on that bit. But then we put in a price guarantee for 12 months. We won't touch the prices, namely because we've put in a clawback in place for that business owner. So if clients leave, we can adjust the value of the deal in the end for the first 12 months. But if they leave, if we turn around and say, right, we're putting up all the prices because you're undercharging, it makes sense. But at the same time, is that fair to then say, well, all those clients left because we put the prices up? So it's your fault as the old business owner?
Yeah.
So we say, no, we won't do anything that will create negativity in the first 12 months of price reviews and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And the first things we do is we go in and we work out, how are they working? So, you know, one of the things we've done in the last acquisition was I was talking to lots of clients and the staff members, looking at all the processes and stuff, and the management accounts were a bit old-fashioned. Like, the clients were all saying, don't know what any of it means, doesn't bear, and I'm sat there going, oh my God, this is the most expensive service that we offer. None of the clients are seeing value in it. No. How long until they all turn around and say, no, I scrap that service and I'm in trouble? So we revamped the management report straight away and went, right, get rid of all of this list of numbers. We went to graphs and charts so they could see pictures and understand those pictures and colours. And we focus on 4 or 5 KPIs in each management report based on an initial meeting with a client, going, right, what keeps you up at night? Mm-hmm. Oh, I need to know this. I need to know that. And this bit worries me and that bit worries me. So cool. That's all we're going to report on. We're not going to bamboozle you with lots of other stuff. That's what we're reporting on. And when that doesn't worry you about it anymore, let us know. And we'll look at something else that is worrying you at the time. So we're constantly going in and improving things in a way that is completely visible to the client. And they go, that's incredible. That's amazing. So I think those are the reasons that we keep such a low loss of clients.
Love that. We have a core value ago proposal that is prove that you care.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that came across for clients, customers, members of Go Proposal was, we of course we care. We would do things all the time to improve, to bring new features, value to our members. But often we weren't showing them.
Yep.
And we needed to bring them along for the journey. So not only do we do these things because we care, we have to make sure people are aware, because they will continue to trust us and back us.
Yep.
So, bit of role playing now. I am, say I'm running a company.
Yep.
Head of Elkington Accounting, LTD. I've got 3 members of staff. My company isn't ridiculously profitable. Let's say I've got a 10% profit margin. So I've got some money there that I can reinvest, but after paying everything, not a lot. I don't do any marketing. I haven't repriced my clients in a while. And I generally feel quite overwhelmed by the amount of work that I do. And my business is not really serving my family anymore. So mm-hmm. I am thinking of selling. But I don't know if I want to do it just yet. So I feel like I can keep going for another 2 to 5 years, somewhere in that bracket.
Yep.
What do I need to do tomorrow? What do I need to do in the next 90 days? And then what do I need to keep consistently doing over the next few years, so that if in, let's say, 3 years' time, I rang you up and you said, absolutely, you're the firm that I want to buy. What do I need to be focusing on today to make that firm as valuable as possible?
So the first thing I'm going to tell you to do is go back and reassess your profitability. Because what you've said there is you're overworked. You're overwhelmed with the work you're doing. That tells me you're too heavily involved in the business. And is that 10% profit before or after you've taken your slice of the pie? So 9 out of 10 times, I'll speak to someone that's got 10, 20% profit. It's like, that's good. That's fine. We're not after the big achiever, you know, big 30, 40% profits necessarily. But when I then throw in replacing you into the cost of running that business, we have a problem because you're not profitable anymore. You're doing the role of an accountant or a practice manager or whatever you're doing. So I've got to replace you. And I can guarantee you're paying yourself probably half of what that role would cost if I replaced it in PayYE. People don't realise that an accountant is £30,000 to £40,000. A good practice manager with accounting experience, £40,000 to £50,000. So when the business owner is only taking out £30,000 themselves a year, actually, your business is hemorrhaging money. And you can't afford to replace yourself. So that's the first thing is, right, where do we find the profitability from? Where do we cut our costs? Where do we upsell? Where do we increase our sales? Where do we, repricing will be an option to get that profit there. Because that profit that you're looking at is not the profit I'm looking at. The profit I'm looking at is, yes, the profit on the P&L, but I'm also looking at how much is it going to cost me to replace you if I needed to replace you? So in my last deal, I didn't need to replace the directors. So the profitability, which was already good, was even better. The cash flow, which was already good, was even better because I didn't need to replace them. Now, sometimes I might get away with not replacing you because I've got capacity elsewhere in my group. You know, if I've got a client manager that could take some more clients on, great. But that shouldn't be a given. Like, as the seller, you shouldn't hope. You shouldn't be working on the assumption, oh, Johan's got a team, they can take over this. What if my team's at full capacity? I'm going to have to replace you. So getting the business processes and systems in place and the pricing right and stuff like that is going to be fundamental, so that actually you can turn around to me and say, yeah, I'm not involved. And I just take the, you know, so you know, you don't need to replace me. Now, I'll quantify that statement as part of my due diligence, but yeah, or I'll look at the rest of your team and go, is there anyone in there that you and I think could step up to replace you? But even if they step up, have they got the capacity? If not, where do I find the capacity from? So even if I'm not bringing in a practice manager because you've got someone there, I might just have to increase their wage by 5-10k a year to cover the new role, but then I still probably have to bring in a 20-25,000 pound bookkeeper to cover off that bit. So I'll look at the most profitable way to do it for you and the most cost efficient, but ultimately at the moment your business isn't even profitable, never mind anything else.
So interesting. And would you go back to, let's stick with me as this firm owner, would you go back to me and ask me to do those things? So the cost cutting, the repricing, replacing yourself, removing yourself from the business before acquisition, or would you suggest you buying that firm at a lower value and then you running that process once they're in?
Both options are on the table. The biggest problem you'll find is the business owner that's selling, ego.
Yeah, okay.
Because they've got in their head, this business is worth £100,000. If I turn around and say, well, actually, it's not, because you're losing money, like you're not profitable. And once we take you out and put someone else in, what am I going to buy that business for?
Yeah.
Like, if you catch me on a good day and I've got capacity, I might turn around and go, oh, that means I'm more profitable elsewhere in my group. And yes, I can make it work, but you're still going to get maybe half the money you think you're going to get.
Yeah.
At which point people go, oh, I'm not selling for that little. And their ego gets in the way. It's very rarely, I say ego quite confidently, because it's very rarely that they've got a commitment of a financial commitment they need to clear with that money. So yeah, 9 out of 10 times it's like, oh, I don't want anyone, we never disclose what we sell and buy for, but there's always a risk that someone's going to find out, like, when GoProposal sold, I mean, the whole industry was rife with rumours and speculations about how much it went for and stuff like that.
I'd love to know what the rumours were. I didn't hear any of those. But
oh, there was plenty. and the same with other softwares that have sold in the last few years. There's always rumours going around, did you hear they went for this and this is the deal structure? It's like, how do you know any of that? It's all speculation.
Also confidential to like the highest of highest contracts.
So ultimately, the risk is, if someone found out I sold my business for that little money, how would I feel?
Yeah.
And that's when the ego gets in the way.
It's the same, it's along the same psychological reasoning as the reason people don't put salary on job ads. Yep. What if my mate at the pub finds out how little I pay my staff? Or what if my other member of staff finds out? Or, and I'm guessing with this, what if the staff find out how much I sold for and want a pay rise, you want a chunk, X, Y, Z. So it's that fear and ego, I can imagine, would come into that.
Yeah. So I could offer you X amount today, but 9 out of 10 times most people would go, no, thank you. So it's like, well, go away, work on these areas. If you can hit these kind of KPI areas, it might be worth this, that, and the other, but that's speculation on what the market's doing in 3 or 4 years' time.
Just before we go to the market, what are those KPI areas? So we've got team, culture, processes.
Profitability.
Let's
get rid of the word profitability. Positive cash flow.
Okay.
The cash flow's got to be in a place where it can financially support the financial commitment of selling the business.
And the state of the market.
Yep.
Yeah. So we know this, the state of the economy, the M&A market governs every single transaction of a company. Hugely with SaaS as well as accounting. So what does that look like today? And what do you think it's going to look like in, just go with 3 years again, when I'm going to sell my accountancy business. So what does it look like today and in 3 years?
Today, the accounting industry is in a good place for sales for the seller.
Mm-hmm.
There's more buyers than there is sellers. So there's lots of firms out there looking to grow for acquisition. And that's great. It means the prices have gone up for the sellers. We're seeing anywhere between 0.8 and 1.3. But
Is that X of revenue, just to be clear?
Of recurring revenue, yeah. So the thing is, though, people will only pay what they think it's worth. So I will look at Smiths and Sons Associates Limited or whatever on the high street. They've been going 50 years, and you can tell that because the whole... everything's in filing cabinets. Everyone's cramped into an office. all the staff are closing to retirement themselves. Like, I'll look at that and go, no, thank you. Not what I'm looking for whatsoever. Someone else will look at that and go, I'll pay 1.5 for this. And it's like, I'm going to go, why?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas they're going, look at all this opportunity. So it's finding the right buyer for the right seller.
Yeah.
It is, not all buyers are looking for the same thing.
Which is like, it's like on Dragon's Den, isn't it? When you put, obviously, the main thing that's important is the cash that swaps hands. But quite often, when they get more than one offer, they'll pick the right buyer because they know one of the dragon has got more experience in the area that they need than the other. And so you are, what's on points accounting groups USP? What's the thing that you can give to the firms then?
I think our main thing that everyone, that all of our sellers have, that sold to us, have always raved about is the trust and the reliability for us to look after their team and their clients. Yeah, you know, like I was chatting to some of the acquisition targets last week, and they were saying, look, we know your reputation in the industry. We knew we could trust you to deliver, but we're still staggered by how quickly and how well you delivered it and how above and beyond you went. So that no one else will get that necessarily. Like if an accountant bookkeeper just rolls them into another firm or something, that is that the feedback they're getting from the sellers and the sellers' former team? So that's something we really pride ourselves on, is the way we look after the team and the way we fold them into our bigger team and make them feel part of the family. And we emphasize the culture and everything we do. And we, as I said earlier, we deliver on it within our days, not months and years. That's really one of the main USPs for us, is our reputation for doing that. Like, we've never made a redundancy. And every single person that's ever came to us as part of an acquisition as a team member is still with us to this day.
I love that. And that's what the reputation for me that you have in the industry that I know. And one of the big reasons we wanted you on this podcast was because you always hear acquisition horror stories, which isn't the case with Go Proposal and Sage, and isn't the case with the ones that you've done, which is they bought the company, they fired the team, and it was great for the money that exchanged hands, but everything in the back end fell to pieces. Yeah. And so it was obviously with Go Pros on Sage, we experienced the opposite of that, in which the team was incredibly looked after. And I know from speaking to people that you've acquired their firms, they have an incredible experience with the way you've dealt with the team, which I'm going to say is definitely coming back to the acquisition that you went through when you were working before your accountancy business.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know what it's like to be brought over by a faceless conglomerate of people that are just looking to profit here.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's not the way I'd want to be perceived myself.
Yeah. Okay, so last thing I want to leave us on then. The accounting and bookkeeping business owners that are listening to this podcast are generally looking for learning, growth and knowledge. And I'd assume the ones that have got to the end of this episode are interested somewhat in their firm being acquired. If you can give hand over one piece of advice for them today from your experience of buying up these firms, what is that one thing, that gem that you'd want them to take away and action or keep with them?
I think it's the same as everything. Keep learning, keep focusing on that topic. So a lot of the accounting conferences this year and into next year, hopefully we'll have this as a key topic for speakers. There's a lot of great insights out there, and if you can't go to conferences or you're not sure, talk to us.
Mm-hmm.
Like Jo Woods only ever called me. Like she dropped me a message on LinkedIn out of the blue, saying, "I know you've brought Bev's business. I'm looking at what my options are. I've started working with a new business coach. She wants to know what my exit plan is. I don't know. I don't even know where we are ready for that. Can we have a chat?" It's like, yeah, of course. More than happy just to have a completely off the record, non-obligatory chat, and I'll tell you what I think of your business and where you're up to and what you might want to work on. Now, after that chat, it happened that Joe's business was exactly where I wanted it. So I made an offer that night, and Joe rang me in the morning saying, I wasn't expecting an offer, but can we talk about that? It's a good offer. So it happened very, very quickly for Joe. Like, she wasn't expecting, she was thinking 2 or 3 years' time. But at the same time, the amount of calls I have where I put the phone down and I've just told them, work on these areas.
Yeah.
Now, either hold yourself accountable to that and go and learn from other insights and stuff from conferences, or there are coaches out there that will help hold your hand to do, to get your business ready. I'm not one of those people. I'll tell you where to look at, but I'm not going to, I don't tell you how to do it because that's not my expertise, as it were. But yeah, just if it's something you want to do, then do what we all do. Listen to podcasts, read books, go to conferences, learn about it, and take action.
It's amazing. Thank you so much, Johan, for being on Firm Up. It's been an absolute honour speaking to you today.
And a pleasure. Thank you.